Wilson Armstead Playhouse. Tonight, NBC presents another in the series of programs, The Nelson Armstead Playhouse, bringing to life the most powerful and compelling short stories ever written, and featuring America's master storyteller, Nelson Armstead.
Good evening. The story the Playhouse Company and I have chosen for you tonight was written by Conrad Aiken. It's the story of a strange journey and a very lovable old man who made it. It's the story of Mr. Ocularis. It seemed that weeks had passed before Mr. Ocularis stood at the window in his room in the hospital and looked down at the street. Leaning against the windowsill, he suddenly felt like crying. It seemed absurd that he should be so weak, so emotional, so like a child, especially now that everything was over at last. In spite of all their predictions, in spite of his own dreadful certainty that he was going to die, here he was, fit as a fiddle, with his whole life before him, and the last words of the doctor still lingering in his ears.
I'd advise a long rest, Mr. Ocularis. A long rest and a change of scenery. Why don't you try England? It's June. It's the perfect month for England.
Yes, what could be more delightful? So why should he feel sad about it and want to cry like a baby? In a few minutes, Harry would arrive with his car and take him to the wharf. In an hour, he'd be out to sea. In 2 hours, he would see the sunset behind them where Boston had been. And his life would be opening up before him. How ridiculous that he should already be homesick. Suddenly, there was a light knock on the door.
Hello, old man.
Harry.
I didn't think the old bus would make it, but she did. Are you all packed up?
Yes.
Good. Here, let me take your arm. You're tottering like an octogenarian.
Oh, come, Harry. Look, if you'll just take the bag.
Can you manage?
Of course. Don't be silly.
Well, come on, then. Careful of the stairs now.
I'll hold on to the rail.
I say, it looks like there's a reception committee.
Why, it's Miss Hoyle and the matron.
And who's the freckle-faced one, the pretty one?
I don't know. She helped prepare me for the operation.
Nice.
Yes. Well, I guess it's goodbye, Miss Hoyle.
Goodbye, Mr. Ocularis, and bon voyage.
Thank you for everything, Miss Hoyle. You were very kind to me, and I fear I was a nuisance.
It was then that the girl with the freckles gave him her hand. She was very pretty, and it would have been easy to fall in love with her. She reminded him of someone. Who was it? He tried in vain to remember while he said goodbye to her. And then suddenly he was going down the front steps, and they were all laughing and waving to him. The wind was cold, very cold for June. He shivered and was glad to put on his coat.
June, why should it be so cold?
East wind. Say, you'd better wrap this blanket around you. It's an open car, and if you're cold...
Yes, thanks. It's grand. It's grand. That's what it is.
What?
Everything.
Oh, yeah. I'll bet it looks good.
There's simply no words.
Sure, I know. You wait until you get out to sea. You will have a swell time.
Oh.
What?
The Harvard Club. We just passed it.
They'll miss you at the bar.
I know, but let there be no moaning.
What's that a quotation from?
The Odyssey.
He didn't mind the small talk. It helped to dissipate the feeling of vagueness and dizziness that came over him in a sickening wave from time to time. All of a sudden, everything would begin to swim and dissolve. Trees would bend at right angles, houses would lean their heads together, and there would be a curious and dreadful humming noise rising and falling in his ears. It must be a touch of fever, he thought. He closed his eyes. Perhaps when he got on the ship, he would have a glass of whiskey. From one of these spells, he opened his eyes and found that they were on the ferry crossing to East Boston.
I say, Omer.
What? Oh, it's you, Harry.
Are you sure you're all right? You act like you're in a daze or something.
Just weak, a little tired, you know, the operation.
From another spell, he woke to find himself in a solitary stateroom with a solitary porthole like the eye of a cyclops staring at him. It was cold inside, very cold. From somewhere, he heard Harry's voice.
Well, I guess everything's okay now. I've got to go, old man. The last whistle just sounded.
Oh,
well, you're half asleep anyway. Goodbye, old fellow. Take care of yourself. Have a good trip and send me back a postcard from the Absolute.
Will you have it finite or infinite?
Oh, infinite, but with your signature on it. Well,
thanks, Harry, for bringing me down here, taking care of me.
Oh, bother it. Look, you'd better turn in for a nap now, and I'd better be going. Cheerio.
Goodbye. Goodbye, Harry.
He sat down in the little wicker chair, closed his eyes. The chair was not too comfortable, and his pain began to bother him again. He went to his narrow berth and, with his overcoat still on, fell asleep. When he woke up, it was dark, and the porthole had been partly opened, and it was cold. It was very cold. The girl who sat opposite him at dinner was charming. Who was it she reminded him of? Why, of course, the girl at the hospital, the girl with the freckles. Her hair was beautiful, not quite red, not quite gold. Her face was freckled. She had a mouth that was both humorous and voluptuous, and she seemed to be alone. He frowned at the bill of fare and ordered the thick soup.
No hors d'oeuvre, sir?
I'm afraid not. They might kill me.
Oh, very well.
I'm afraid you shocked him.
Impossible. These stewards, they're dead souls. How could they be stewards otherwise? So blasé, they think they've seen and known everything.
It must be a dreadful sort of life.
It's because they're dead that they accept it.
Do you think so?
I'm sure of it. I'm enough of a dead soul myself to know the signs.
Aren't you being a little mysterious?
Not at all. You see, I'm just out of the hospital, an operation. I was given up for dead. In fact, for 6 months, I had given myself up for dead. If you've ever been seriously ill, you know the feeling, a mild, cynical tolerance for everything and everyone.
I wish I could understand, but I've never been ill in my life.
Never?
Never.
Then pay no attention to invalids or they'll drag you into the hospital.
You don't look like an invalid.
Mr. Ocularis thought her completely charming. His pain had ceased to bother him, and the disagreeable humming sound disappeared, or rather it was dissociated from himself and became merely, as it should be, the sound of the ship's engines. He began to think that the voyage was going to be really delightful. The steward, hovering nearby, placed the salt shaker before him.
I fear you'll need this for your soup.
Oh, thank you. Is it as bad as that?
Well, it's the first day out, sir. Everything's apt to be a little upset. It's that way every trip.
Tell me, steward, do you think we'll have a good voyage?
Well, madam, I don't like to be a Jeremiah.
Oh, come now. I hope we have no Jeremiahs.
What do you mean?
Well, maybe I shouldn't say it. But there's a corpse on board, going to Ireland. I never yet knew a voyage with a corpse on board that we didn't have bad weather.
Mr. Ocularis felt a shudder go through him. A corpse in the hold, a coffin. Perhaps it was true. Perhaps some disaster would befall him. There might be fogs, there might be icebergs. No, but that couldn't be. He forced himself to speak.
Silly, isn't it?
What is?
These old seagoing superstitions. I wonder how such delusions arise.
From fear, I suppose. Just fear.
Yes, I suppose.
Mr. Ocularis looked at her and again tried to think of whom she reminded him.
It wasn't only the little freckle-faced girl at the hospital. It was someone else, someone far back in life. Remote, beautiful, lovely. But he couldn't think. And then suddenly, the room grew stuffy and the ship's engines became both audible and palpable. The throbbing seemed to be the rhythm of his own pain. Fighting for a moment's control, he excused himself from the table and left the room. He made his way with slow steps toward his stateroom, holding onto the walls in his moments of weakness and dizziness. It was cold in the room. He untied his tie slowly, looking at his face in the glass, and wondered. From time to time, he put his hand to his side to hold in the pain. He sank into his narrow berth, pulled the blankets about him. He fell asleep. The sense of time was already hopelessly confused. 1 hour was like another. The sea was always the same. Morning was indistinguishable from afternoon. And then, was it Tuesday or Wednesday? Mr. Ocularis found that he was too tired, too incapable of concentration to answer his own questions. He looked at Miss Dean, who was sitting beside him in a deck chair. He didn't know whether he ought to tell her, but then he had to. He couldn't go on keeping it to himself any longer.
Miss Dean, tell me, did you ever walk in your sleep?
No, I never have.
That's a funny part of it. Neither have I. Until last night. Never in my life. I hardly ever dream. It really rather frightens me.
Tell me about it, Mr. Arcularis.
I dreamed at first that I was walking alone in a wide plain covered with snow. It was growing dark. I was very cold. My feet were frozen and numb, and I was lost. I came then to a signpost. First, it seemed to me there was nothing on it, nothing but ice. Just before it grew finally dark, however, I made out on it the one word, Polaris. Anyway, it gave me a feeling of awful despair. And then the dream changed. And this time, it seemed I was standing outside my stateroom, trying to find the door handle to let myself in. I was in my pajamas, and again, I was very cold. And at this point, I woke up. And the extraordinary thing is, that's exactly where I was.
Good heavens, how strange.
Yes, and now the question is, where had I been? I was frightened when I came to, not unnaturally. For among other things, I did have the impression that I had quite definitely been somewhere. Somewhere where it was very cold.
I don't know what to say, but please don't worry about it. It's nothing, I'm sure.
I've never done such a thing before.
She reached out and put her hand on his. And when he looked at her, her eyes met his gently, sympathetically, as if for the exchange of something unspoken and perhaps unspeakable. The thought occurred to him, was it possible that he was falling in love? He'd read of such things? But then at his age, and with a girl of 22. It was some time later that he went to bed. In the darkness, which normally rather frightened him, he remembered the soft warmth of her hair. Its brightness made him unafraid. The rhythm of the ship's engines was positively a persecution. It gave him no rest. It followed him like the hound of heaven, driving him out into space and across the Milky Way. It was cold there, and Mr. Ocularis sparkled with frost. He felt like a Christmas tree, icicles on his fingers and icicles on his toes. He tinkled and spangled in the void, hallooed to the waste echoes, rounded the boy on the verge of the unknown, and tacked glimmering homeward. The wind whistled. Snowflakes and tinsel blew past him. He was cold, 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 but enjoying it. Suddenly it was dark and he was lost. He groped, touched cold, slippery woodwork with his fingernails, looking for an electric switch. Electric switch.
Where had he been? He'd gone farther this time than the night before. Another deck down. It had been colder.
But where? Where have I been? Where am I going?
Suddenly he closed his eyes and began to tremble. A dreadful idea had occurred to him.
It's nothing serious, Doctor. Of course, it's nothing serious.
No, no, it's nothing serious.
I knew you'd think so, but just the same...
Such a condition is usually the result of worry. Are you worried about anything?
No, I don't think so.
It's very strange.
I'll say it's strange. I've come to see for a rest, not a nightmare. What about a bromide?
Well, I can always give you a bromide, Mr. Ocularis.
Then please, if you don't mind, give me a bromide.
He took a dose at once and then went on deck. In a little while, Miss Dean joined him. They leaned, shoulders touching, on the deck rail and looked at the sea. Mr. Ocularis scanned the horizon in vain for an iceberg and then casually said,
Well, I saw the doctor today.
What did he say?
It's nothing serious. Yet, I still worry about it.
But is it anything to worry about, really?
No, I suppose not.
Then don't worry. We aren't children any longer.
Aren't we? I wonder.
Come. Let's go into dinner, shall we?
No, if you don't mind, I'm going to take a short nap. I'll join you in the lounge after dinner.
Are you sure you're all right?
Of course. Please don't worry.
But I do.
I just want to rest a little. It's very tiresome, you know, rambling about the cosmos at night. No, you go into dinner. I'll join you later.
Mr. Ocularis was finding it impossible to keep warm. A cold fog surrounded the ship. The sun had all but disappeared, and the transition from day to night was almost unnoticeable. The ship, too, seemed scarcely to be moving. It was as if it were anchored among walls of ice and rime. By day, he wore his heavy coat and sat shivering in the corner of the smoking room. By night, he heaped blankets on his bed and closed the porthole against the sea. But despite everything, the fog crept in and icy fingers touched his throat. His teeth chattered. His hands were blue. How long would it last, he thought? How long? They surely ought to be past the Grand Banks by this time. And surely it wasn't necessary to sail to England by way of Greenland and Iceland. And then the dreams, the sleepwalking. That night, Miss Dean, Clarice, was sympathetic.
It's all simply because your vitality has been so lowered by your illness. You can't expect to be your normal self so soon after an operation. When was your operation, by the way?
Oh, heaven knows, ages ago. When I was a tadpole and you were a fish.
Oh, be serious.
Perhaps when I was a Neanderthal man with a club.
Are you sure it isn't farther back still?
Not at all. Why, we've been on this ship for eons, and even here I've had plenty of time in my nocturnal wanderings to go several times to Orion and back. I'm thinking, by the way, of going farther still. You know, there's a nice little star to the left as you round the Pleiades, which looks as if it might be right on the edge, the last outpost of the finite. I think I'll have a look at it and bring you back a rhyme feather.
It would melt when you got it back.
Oh, no. Not on this ship.
I wish I could go with you.
If only you would. If only...
Mr. Ocularis broke off his sentence and looked at her. How lovely she was, how desirable. No such woman had ever come into his life. There had been no one with whom he'd felt so profound a sympathy and understanding. It was a miracle, simply a miracle. No need to put his arm around her or kiss her, delightful as such things would be. He had only to look at her to feel that she knew him, that she had always known him. It was, indeed, as if she might be his own soul. But as he looked thus at her, he noticed that she was frowning.
What is it?
I don't know.
The way you're looking at me, why?
It's nothing. It just occurred to me that perhaps you weren't looking so well.
Oh, nonsense. Of course, this pain bothers me now and then, and I feel rather weak, but...
It's more than that. Much more than that. Something is worrying you horribly. Something you've been fighting against all day. Tell me, did you walk again?
Yes. Yes, I did. It's ghastly. It's killing me.
I knew. Tell me.
It's happened twice now. And each time I was farther away, the same dream of going round a star, the same terrible coldness and helplessness, that awful whistling curve.
And when you woke up?
First time, I was at the farther end of the dining room.
And the next time?
I was at the bottom of the stairway that leads to the hold, past the refrigerating plant. It was dark, and I was crawling on my hands and knees. Crawling on my hands and knees.
Do you think?
Yes, I know. And so do you. Twice more. Three times. And I'll be looking down into an empty...
It was then that they first embraced. Then, at the edge of the infinite, at the last signpost of the finite, they clung together desperately, forlornly, weeping as they kissed each other, staring hard one moment and closing their eyes the next. Passionately, passionately she kissed him, as if she were indeed trying to give him her warmth, her life. She leaned back from him then and took his face between her two hands, her hands, which were wet with his tears.
But what nonsense. What utter nonsense. It can't be.
It is.
How do you know? How do you know where the...
Don't be afraid to say it, darling. You mean the coffin?
How could you know where it is?
I don't need to. I'm already almost there.
That night, before they separated, they had several cocktails at the bar.
Let's make it gay tonight. Above all, let's make it that way.
Yes.
Perhaps even now it'll turn out to be nothing but a nightmare from which both of us will awake. And even at the worst, at my present rate of travel, I ought to need two more nights. It's a long way still to that little star.
And if you reach it?
Then I'll probably come back. In time. Yes, most certainly, in time. Perhaps it will be like Ulysses' return. Tattered, torn, unknown after my odyssey among the stars.
I'll know you.
Penelope knew Ulysses too. But then she was his wife.
I'll remember.
My faithful Penelope.
Later, they walked once around the deck and leaned on the railing and stared into the fog. It was thicker and whiter than ever. The ship was scarcely moving. The rhythm of the engines was slower than ever before. There was a profound stillness about them. When at last they parted, it was, by tacit agreement, on a note of the ridiculous.
Be a good boy now, darling, and take your bromide.
Yes, Mother, I'll take my medicine.
In his stateroom, he mixed himself a strong potion of bromide and got into bed. He would have no trouble in falling asleep. He felt more tired, more supremely exhausted than he'd ever been in his life. Nor had bed ever seemed so delicious. And then suddenly the long, familiar, magnificent swoop of dizziness. The great circle. The swift pathway to Arcturus. It was all as before, but infinitely more rapid. Never had Mr. Ocularis achieved such phenomenal, such supernatural speed. It was no time at all that he was beyond the moon. He shot past the North Star as though it were standing still, swooped in a long, bright curve round the Pleiades, and shouted his frosty greeting to Betelgeuse. Then he was off to the little blue star which pointed the way to the unknown.
There's the star. There it is. Courage, old man, and hold on to your umbrella. They're coming closer and closer.
And when we get there, there'll be that frozen rhyme feather for Penelope. No, Clarice, not Penelope. And then we'll break it off and come flying back to her. Flying back, and she'll remember. And then home. Home. Home.
Mr. Ocularis rushed on and on, passing the dead stars, passing the burned-out constellations in his journey to the little blue star. It was getting cold and dark, and the little blue star was beginning to fade before him. And suddenly, Mr. Ocularis was lonely. He desperately wanted to return to the ship. But the stars had winked out around him, and everywhere there was night and the terrible wind blowing, and suddenly he began to fall. Downward he plunged, through constellations and dying stars, through darkness and ice, downward toward the dark sea, the broad waste of sea where something bobbed and floated, something long and narrow and empty. Downward he fell, twisting and turning toward the empty thing. And he was freezing. 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 At this point in the void, the surgeon's last efforts to save Mr. Ocularis' life had failed. He stood back from the operating table and made a tired gesture with a rubber-gloved hand. "It's all over," he said, "as I expected." He looked at the nurse, whose gaze was downward at the basin she held. Her freckles stood out sharply against her pale skin. There was a moment's stillness, a pause, a brief flight of unexchanged comment. And then the ordered life of the hospital was resumed.
This has been the narrative dramatization of a short story by Conrad Aiken entitled Mr. Ocularis. Now again, here is Nelson Olmsted.
Well, racial and religious antagonism has grown increasingly bitter since the war ended. We must guard ourselves and our families against infection by such intolerance. And we can work through our church, our business, our labor union, our school, to emphasize and promote the principles of racial and religious freedom. For 5 long years, we fought a war to preserve these, among other things, of our heritage. It would be tragic to lose them now in peace. Our story tonight, Mr. Ocularis, was adapted for radio by Frederick J. Lipp and directed by Herbert Lateau. Mr. Ocularis was played by Herb Butterfield, Miss Dean by Charlene Osgood. The orchestra was directed by Joseph Colicchio with original music by Emil Soderstrom. Next week, our story is entitled Conquest. It was written by Leonard Lee, and it's the story of men against Mount Everest, of one man against himself. It's a good story, and I know you'll like it, so try to be with us. Until next week, then, this is Nelson Olmsted saying good night and good reading.
This was a Chicago production. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.
This is Chicago, WMAQ.